Hi, and welcome to another episode of The Law Down, the podcast where we talk about the employment law and partnership law angles behind stories in the news. My name is Wani Sander, and today I am joined by two of my colleagues, Pooja Dasgupta and Sarah Chilson. And we've got three stories that we are going to talk about on today's podcast. The first one is one that could not have been avoided over the last few weeks, which is the Philip Schofield story and him resigning from ITV and the investigation that is subsequently taking place. The second story is about Amazon's new offering to parents, allowing them to have term time working contracts. And our third story is around BlackRock and Lloyds calling their employees back to the office for more days working face-to-face in the office. So first of all, to kick off, I'm going to hand over to Pooja, who's going to set out some of what's been happening with this Philip Schofield story.
Thanks, Wanu. So I don't think I need to do much of an introduction to this story. It seems, I think, that every day there seems to be a new development in the Philip Schofield story. But in summary, for those who don't know, who I'm sure do know about it. Anyway, Philip Schofield resigned from hosting This Morning, as we know, last week, as he admitted to having an unwise but not illegal affair with a younger male colleague and then lying about it, not only to ITV, but also his colleagues, agents, the media and the public. And so ITV bosses are now facing questions from everyone, essentially, but also MPs over the scandal. And they have instructed Jane Mackay KC to carry out an external review into Schofield's departure from the show amidst reports of a toxic environment behind the scenes. And there, ITV is said to have investigated the affair back in late 2019, early 2020, when rumours had started about the affair. But it seems that those involved are said to have denied it and have continued to do so until as recently as this month. And so, when thinking about this in an employment context and drawing parallels, this seems to be a type of situation where the cover-up is arguably worse than the crime, in circumstances where Schofield denies any illegality associated with his relationship with the ITV employee. And obviously that's going to be looked into further, I'm sure, as part of the review. But then it's the subsequent repeated dishonesty which is what seems to have brought about the immediate end of his career with ITV and the tarnishing, the wide scale tarnishing of his reputation and the strength of feeling around it. And so obviously Schofield resigned in the end, but if he hadn't have resigned, it seems that based on what we know, and obviously we don't know everything, and I feel like we are being drip-fed information every day, so it's impossible to say, give a concrete view on what would have happened, but ITV would likely have had a legitimate basis to take disciplinary action based, again, on what we know, it being suggested that when the affair was previously investigated, Schofield denied that the affair had happened. And this type of dishonesty issue, as we know, could potentially constitute an express breach of contract and or result in a breakdown of the trust and confidence between Schofield and ITV in and of itself. And also, for example, if you look at a regulated environment, this type of dishonesty issue can also constitute a breach of regulatory obligations, which is often something we look at in the type of work that we do. And these types of issues can have really serious consequences in internal processes, often resulting in dismissal. Although, of course, there could have been mitigating circumstances to take into account before reaching any conclusion. For example, the fact that Schofield only divulged his sexual orientation in early 2020. So these types of issues may well have been taken into account in any internal process that would likely have been followed had Schofield not resigned. And it's also worth mentioning that ITV may have had a relationships at work policy, which is becoming increasingly commonplace for organisations. And Schofield's failure to disclose a relationship, which would potentially have involved a conflict of interest, may have fallen foul of any such policy, potentially also warranting disciplinary action in and of itself. And this, I think, this conflict of interest potential abuse of power issue is an issue that's at the forefront of what's happening, and is something that we're all focusing on. And it will again be interesting to see the findings that are reached in the review on that. And we know that employers often include in their examples of serious misconduct, gross misconduct, matters bringing the organisation into serious disrepute. And obviously this issue has led to widespread negative media scrutiny for ITV, or also, you know, matters which irreparably damage the working relationship and trust between the company and the employee. Now, obviously, this hasn't just led to a breakdown between ITV and Schofield, but also a breakdown between him and the other presenters, Holly Willoughby, other members of the team, etc. So you can definitely see how matters would have panned out had Philip Schofield not resigned. And, you know, we do often see and hear of individuals wanting to essentially get ahead of the internal process by resigning. But those implications of these types of allegations don't simply cease upon resignation for those who are, for example, regulated, or those who are already in the public eye, like Philip Schofield is, for whom arguably the reputational damage has already been done, even though he's resigned. So, you know, I think we just need to see what happens and wait to see what the findings are from the external review. No doubt that will shed further light on the extent of the cover-up and will potentially affect more people than just Schofield, and will likely cause more reputational damage for ITV. So no doubt they are taking advice on, you know, what they should be doing from a PR perspective. And those are my kind of initial views. Interested to hear what your thoughts are on it, Sarah.
Yeah, it's a really interesting case, I think, on all sides. And I think that point that you picked up on around the cover-up being worse than the crime is something we also see often in the work that we do, where someone has been accused of the underlying misconduct. And when they are presented with the allegation, instead of kind of coming clean, and also, you know, depending on what it involves, sometimes if it's criminal, there are reasons as to why they might, you know, take advice or refuse to answer in that specific instance. But oftentimes people will try and cover up what they've done. They will try and hide evidence, delete evidence, lie about it. And often that can make it worse, because as you've identified, if you are in a regulated industry, often you will have higher obligations of integrity and honesty, and failing to be truthful and honest when you're asked a direct question by your employer is potentially failing to be honest and showing that you lack integrity. And there are obviously lots of professional industries where we are meant to hold a higher standard. And because of that profession, for example, in the financial services industry, when you're dealing with people's money, in the legal services industry, where people come to you as a, you know, trusted confidant, in those situations, you are expected to be not necessarily beyond reproach, but definitely hold a higher standard. And so it does become an issue. And so I think, you know, the same thing with Philip Schofield, as you've said, he's in the public eye, and often when someone of that sort of caliber falls below the standard that somebody might, that the general public expect, it looks all the worse for them, doesn't it? That they've tried to cover it up and try to hide what they've done. But the second thing that I thought was worth kind of drawing out is this idea around how to sensitively deal with these sorts of issues when there is potential misconduct, but you have an individual who is the alleged perpetrator, who is also potentially vulnerable and whose well-being and mental health needs to be considered in the bigger picture as well. So in stories that have sort of later come out, and in his own interviews, I think there had been discussion around the impact that it's having on him and his personal life, and, you know, what anybody might want to say about the underlying allegations. I think it's important, and we see it in our work as sort of paramount as well, that anybody involved in these kinds of cases are delicate and sensitive, dealing with the individual being accused, you know, giving them the support, giving them counselling, giving them, you know, somebody to speak to, because it's such a difficult process for everyone involved. And in our cases, often, you know, the allegations are being looked into, the investigation is underway and there has been no final findings. So, you know, at that stage, and even afterwards, but particularly at the stage when they're going through it and there's no final findings yet, it's really important to ensure that you're continually giving that support, you're continually ensuring that person's mental health is being prioritized as well. So yeah, I think it's a difficult situation all around. It obviously, from my perspective, I think it is right that it's being looked into. And as you say, we'll have to see what the outcome of the investigation is.
I think also just to round it off, I agree with all of that one. I think just it's interesting as well that Philip Schofield has been able to present his view in an interview afterwards, which often, you know, isn't possible in circumstances where there's the person might still be employed and pending investigation and they're not able to put their because they're subject to kind of really strict confidentiality instructions. That's also something that's different in this situation where he has resigned and he's obviously not, or as far as we're aware, he's not bound by confidentiality instructions restricting him from putting across his side of what's happened. And, you know, that might be something that he feels he needs again to kind of preserve his reputation, mental health, well-being. But that's something that we don't always see in these types of investigations.
I think one thing I wondered is as well, it highlights, I think, the employer's obligation to everyone involved. So I know one of you spoke about that, you know, looking after people, etc. But actually, they also have duties to protect, for example, the health and safety of junior members of staff or younger members of staff for vulnerable people. And I wonder, you know, one possible outcome of their internal investigation may be that they did not adequately protect everybody involved in this situation. And so, you know, I think a lot of the focus has been on Philip Schofield, but in any context, an employer needs to make sure that they are continually protecting people from harm, from potential abuse of power, from potential wrongdoing, and looking after those people after the event. You know, if there is an investigation, that, as you say, one is really difficult and traumatic for everybody involved, and adequate supports need to be provided for anyone involved.
Yeah, completely agree. There's always multiple stakeholders, so to speak. And yeah, it's for an employer to sort of balance and make sure all of those are considered. So thank you, Pooja. The next story we're going to talk about is this story about Amazon UK, who are offering parents term time only working. It's actually being offered to both parents and grandparents who work in Amazon's UK warehouse. And in the future, the idea is that they're going to be able to opt in to work only in term time. So this is actually being seen generally positively because it's allowing flexible working really for people who might have other responsibilities, particularly people who will need the time of, you know, school term times, summer holidays, Easter periods, to be able to look after children and grandchildren. I think it's a good idea. It's in sort of inviting more involvement of different types of people who have different types of schedules and responsibilities. And often there's also the argument actually that it will help save those families finances or, you know, spending on childcare costs if they're able to be able, you know, fix their sometime working and spend that time looking after the children during the holidays and not having to spend that money on childcare. It's an interesting concept. One thought I had is that actually for a lot of industries and businesses, it's not necessarily going to be that easy to implement across the board because it's not suitable for all jobs. A lot of jobs will require continuous working throughout the year, whereas Amazon, particularly their fulfillment centres and their warehouses, are quite suited to sort of part-time working, to shift working, where people are working at different times of the day, on the weekends. But in your sort of standard, might want to call it standard office job, 9 to 5, where you need someone in from Monday to Friday, you know, throughout the year, that might be a little bit more difficult to implement. That's not to say that employers shouldn't be thinking about how they can assist employees who might have other responsibilities, caregiving responsibilities, child caregiving responsibilities, how they can assist them with having more flexible working pattern, and employees are entitled to request flexible working. Employers are also, as we're going to speak about later, entitled to refuse it on certain grounds. But where that can be embedded into the employer's working arrangement. So for example, if there was some sort of shift working system within the office setup. So if you had a group of workers who you know will be there during term time, during holiday time, because they don't have those additional responsibilities, or they wouldn't otherwise want to use it, because there has to be sort of caretaker, not to discriminate against people because they don't have that caregiving responsibility, then you might be able to set up a sort of system that replicates a sort of shift working arrangement. But I think it would still be more difficult for the sort of typical type of working environment than for an employer like Amazon and the sort of work that they do. I think that's really my main comment on it. I think it's a good thing. And there has also been some criticism that this is not the only area that Amazon needs to improve on in terms of benefits and for their, you know, benefits for their employees. There's been a lot of talk about their pay and conditions. There has been a drive, I think, for them to have union recognition within some of these warehouses, because they've been concerned about the fact that the amount that they're being paid simply isn't enough. So I guess what I would say to that is, you know, as an employer can introduce these kind of benefits, these kind of flexible arrangements, they do have to look at the rounded picture of what they're offering to their employees, because that might not be the solution to all of the concerns that their employees have. And that's basically what I wanted to say on it. I don't know if you have any other observations, Sarah or Pooja.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's incredibly positive to at least be giving thought to these types of kind of flexible arrangements. But what it really comes down to is, you know, if it's in line with operational needs and that it avoids kind of discrimination risk by in the way that these arrangements are applied. And but I do think it's great to have the option, and as long as it's thought through in a considered way, and if it works for the business and it works for that individual, and it doesn't, you know, create a burden on the rest of their team, then I think, you know, if it's workable, then it makes total sense. But you just need to give really careful thought as to those other risks, the business risks, the commercial risks, and also the kind of legal risks too.
Yeah, and I think what you say towards the end is that there's got to be a balance between, I mean, benefits are great, and obviously assisting working parents and caregivers with flexibility, particularly during school holidays, which you know, must be a total nightmare to cover, is great. But ultimately, if you're not paying people enough to, you know, put food on the table in a cost of living crisis, and that might be something that you really need to address as a priority. And it's interesting as well, because, you know, whilst they're obviously trying to negate the need for school holiday childcare, there are a lot of parents facing exorbitant childcare costs. I mean, our childcare costs are the most expensive in the world, I think. And so, you know, ultimately, parents need support. So I think it's great to think about these things, and it's great to have some employers trialing different approaches to helping working parents and caregivers. But it's got to be balanced with sort of the overall package, I think. And, you know, I'm sure a lot of people would quite like to have a pay rise if they work at Amazon, particularly in the current climate when things are just getting more and more and more expensive and difficult to manage, particularly if you have factor in childcare costs and rising mortgages and rising rents.
Yeah. And I think that's an issue across the board. I'd probably just to even out the to balance out the view there, Amazon had given their workers a one-off £500 cost of living payment, and apparently to 50p pay increases in the past 12 months. I think the point being that everyone is going through this cost of living crisis and is being squeezed, and so that still is not sufficient for a lot of workers to actually just get, you know, to get by.
Including a lot of, we haven't even spoken about the strikes, but I mean, there's a lot of government employees who haven't seen a pay rise for a very long time. So, you know, and sadly, there isn't just one employer or more than one employer, one sector, which is affected by this.
Indeed. And that segues us, I think, into our final story of today's podcast, which is to do with BlackRock and Lloyds, who are calling their staff to the office after the pandemic, to work more days in the office. Sarah, can you give us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so I think it's not just them, actually. There's a number of different financial services institutions which are trying to people back into the office more days a week. So typically post-pandemic, people have never got back into the office, much as I think our government would sometimes like to have been the case for those, what was it, water cooler moments that I think our Prime Minister so yearns to be reignited. But BlackRock and Lloyds have attracted particular coverage. So BlackRock want people back in the office 4 days a week as part of their proposals. And that is not a particularly popular proposal. And Lloyds are looking to increase people's days to a minimum of 2 days a week, which is 40%, which is quite a common requirement across lots of office-based sectors, I'd say, from looking at what various different businesses are doing. And they are planning to introduce sort of monitoring and then potential ramification formal steps if people don't meet those requirements, and with some sort of clocking in, clocking out system. There was also reported in the context of Lloyds that they were looking to review the compressed working arrangements that some people had in place, which I think is potentially more problematic for people because that actually takes the number of days someone works and changes them. And it was particularly highlighted in the context of people who've got care and responsibilities, who have got care in place on particular days and trying to rearrange that care. Sometimes there's waiting lists, or, you know, if it's care for unwell or elderly adults, it can just not be possible to change that very quickly. Or for childcare, you know, wait lists are 2 years for some nurseries, for example. So, you know, requiring people to suddenly start coming in 5 days a week when they have always done 4 days a week or have done for a significant period of time because they work compressed hours could be quite a disruption and force some people to leave their jobs. Which obviously does nothing for the gender pay gap if these people end up sort of out of work and having to go and apply for new work elsewhere. So, I mean, there's a number of issues. I mean, as we've discussed already, flexible working is something that can be requested by anybody, and an employer can have to grant it, but they do need to think about it carefully and apply a particular process and can only reject it if they've got a reason to do so. In reality, most businesses can find a reason that applies to them if they want to, and there's very little that employees individually can do to necessarily challenge the flexible working decision. But there are risks for employers that a decision to reject flexible working may constitute some form of discrimination. For example, maybe that there is indirect sex discrimination. We know statistically that the majority of childcare, for example, is done by women. Majority of women will work part-time versus men in terms of taking, you know, time off to look after children. And therefore, statistically, it's accepted that failure to offer part-time working or flexible working without justification may constitute indirect sex discrimination. So employers who are looking to radically overhaul the flexible working regimes and have an impact on their workforce and their ability to discharge their care obligations do need to be really careful about that, I think. So, I mean, I think there's a difficult balance to be struck because I definitely see that there is benefit to be had from some presence in an office or a place of work with people that you work with. And in some cases, that's also to, you know, meet with clients and meet with external stakeholders. But there are also benefits to be had from allowing people to be at home some days a week and do a different type of work there. And so it very much depends upon someone's role and whether they can do that job from home or whether they just can't. And in some cases, they will not be able to do it from home 5 days a week. In some cases, they will. And artificially forcing people into a place of work does seem to me to be a bit unfair when it's, if it's absolutely not necessary. But equally, you know, where it is necessary, I think employers should absolutely feel empowered to request that of their employees.
Yeah, I think the common argument that's put forward since the pandemic is that we're still, you know, getting our hours in, we're still delivering everything we need to be delivering from home, and especially in, you know, industries where you record your time, for example, you can clearly see how much time has been put in at home, and if people are still, that argument that people are sometimes more productive doing certain types of work at home, but You know, on the flip side to that, there are other, as you say, so there are other considerations. It needs to be kind of tailored to that person's role, and, you know, opportunities for promotion may be reliant on people being present in person, you know, meeting clients, meeting, you know, doing certain kind of managerial type of duties that you can only do in person. So you have to take more of a holistic approach in kind of looking at exactly, as you say, Sarah, looking exactly what that role need, what is needed of that role, and where they need to be doing what.
I think that's right. Ollie, what do you think?
No, I completely agree. And I think there has to be, you need to take the temperature of your organisation really as well, because, you know, employers will inevitably be battling for talent as well. And I think they've learned through the pandemic that there are very different generations in the workforce at the moment. And a lot of the generations that are looking for flexible working, going to generalise here, but will be the, you know, younger generation as well, because they might have different interests and things that they have outside of work that they want to make sure that they have some flexibility to be able to fit in a sort of good work-life balance, and how many times they have to come into the office. I've even heard just anecdotally, it tends to be quite a big benefit, you know, even though it's not, you know, it's not financial, but it's a big benefit when it comes to, you know, assessing whether or not a workplace is a place of choice for them or not. So I think it's important from a cultural perspective that employers have that dialogue as well with their employees, and it not be a sense of just an imposition, because they would not, you know, to avoid having a situation where something's imposed and the result of it is potentially, you know, losing staff. That's probably not what most employers want. And so I think it is important to kind of sit back and make sure they have that assessment. But as you say, Sarah, if there are, you know, if there's business need, if there's been genuine, you know, assessments made about, you know, whether or not people are being effective working at home, whether or not people are being supported working at home, because there could be more junior staff who working at home is not effective for them. They are not getting the support and the training that they need by working at home. Those sorts of assessments that identify a business need where returning to the office for longer periods of time or for a greater proportion of the week makes sense for that business and makes sense for the people that work in that business. So yeah, I think it's a balance, but I do think culture is a big piece to think about.
And I guess to finish off that point as well, there might be, you know, regulatory obligations required of companies, firms that mean that they need to take an even greater kind of consideration of those, the cultural piece and supervision as well. So they might be, it might form part of their wider kind of regulatory overview of their obligations too.
Yeah. And I think in terms of implementing change, I think what people, I guess both sides need to remember is that employers need to consult. You know, they can't unilaterally change something that has become a right or a contractual term for a group of employees or an employee individually. But ultimately, I think employers also need to be realistic that where an employer feels they can justify it, so push through a change in a consultation. So, you know, they will try and protect themselves against the risk of constructive dismissal by unilaterally imposing a change, you know, try and consult. And in a lot of cases, there's not much an employee can do about it, except, I suppose, as I say, about look at whether there's some discrimination issues for them. One other issue that struck me as you were talking, Wanu, is that I think a lot of the time, and I guess we all maybe have something to do with this in the current climate, people can't really afford to live anywhere near where they work. And, you know, the cost of public transport is extortionate. And I think often, you know, you talk about the sort of generational issue, but I think what was quite kind of different, you know, decades ago was the cost of housing and the ability to live somewhere vaguely commutable. And I think now that has shifted a lot. And, you know, employers, I guess, need to just be aware of all these different factors that are causing people to want to work flexibly.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Well, thank you very much for listening to The Law Down. We hope you enjoyed the episode. If you want to find out any more about some of the topics we've spoken about today, we have lots of resources and material on our website, www.cm-murray.com. Otherwise, we will see you next time. Thanks.